The chat too.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Cody Kim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take tolerance, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite anarchist show on the internet. Just because I say so, of course. Well, how you doing, Charnchi? You there?
Hey, you Bolshevik.
Mr. 1001 Bolsheviks, right? Well,
yeah.
I guess that's the reputation I get for not wanting to come, for wanting to get some gradual improvements here. Hey, you know, I wish I could just press a button and the whole thing would go away, but can't really do that. But, you know, since people are requesting that, I think we should devote most of this show to talk about some of the more idealized sort of theories about anarchism. We won't talk about so much about recent news. We won't talk about so much about, getting single payer or stuff like that, or a public option or whatnot. We're going to talk about the law. We're going to talk about authority. We're going to talk about hierarchy. We're going to get to the nitty gritty of the reason of the theory and the different strategies to get there. But are you familiar with the infoshop.org website, and particularly the anarchist FAQ?
I've read parts of it, and I've messed around with the site a little bit, but sometimes it's not as smooth as it can be. Like, you know, pages will be missing and all that, so, but it's a good resource.
Yeah, it definitely is, and one of the parts that I actually hadn't read till quite recently, and by the way, I want to tell the audience that I want to start doing this, because I never do it. You can call in, and the number is 646 646-8106. That's the guest number. Once again, 646-716-8106. So call in and ask any questions you want.
Also, Jonathan, yep. Here's the website too.
Oh, the website, you mean the one where we store the shows, or?
Yeah.
Well, I think that where we store the shows is, authoritysmashers.wordpress.com. You guys know the WordPress website, so authoritysmashers.wordpress.com, and then I think the Blog Talk Radio, I think the Blog Talk Radio website is blogtalkradio.com / Authority Smashers. Is that what it is? I think so. So just look for Authority Smashers on Blog Talk if you want to listen to it live. But anyway, so yeah, I guess the first thing we're going to talk about is the law, right? So we go to school, we listen to the news, and we talk about, and we are sort of conditioned to believe that the law as we know it is something that is written in stone, that it law is necessary to take care of society, and the government needs to enforce the laws and so on. The problem is, I think it comes down to something that John Milton said a few hundred years ago. He said, "Those who put out the people's eyes reproach them of their blindness." In other words, the system corrupts the people, and then the people are perceived to be corrupt, and therefore they need the paternalistic heavy hand of the state to regulate the people, right? That's one side of it. Then the other side of it, we don't talk about it that much, is that if you just simply use certain measures to count the number of crimes, like say count the number of people killed or the number of dollars stolen from people, and it turns out that the most criminal institutions tend to be the very same institutions that shape the law. So for example, government and corporations have directly or indirectly killed millions of people, right? Even the most democratic governments, like supposedly our government. They've, of course, stolen countless amounts of money from people, right? So they have committed many crimes. Now, at the same time, the argument is, well, you know, if they weren't there, we would have, everybody would be killing each other and so on. And the problem is that the argument that is leveled against that is that human beings have an intrinsic morality, and they have an intrinsic intelligence that is being underutilized in our system, because when you are subject to the paternalistic and authoritarian mandates of bosses, of the government, you know, capitalism, subject to the influences of materialism, greed, and all the values that our society sort of spreads, starting right at the very beginning when you go to school, and all those values mean that when people make decisions about justice, they tend not to rely on their own moral judgment, but rather on the judgment of a superior, so-called superior entity, like the government, an authority figure. And I would like to give you an example of something that I experienced a few years ago, I think it was a year and a half ago, when I had jury duty, right? So this was 2 years ago. I had jury duty, and I wanted to experiment, you know. So when there's a moment when you have jury duty, where the judge asks you, well, if you disagree with a decision, will you nevertheless follow the law, right? And I wanted to see, it was not an important case. It was somebody stole something minor. I said, well, not necessarily, because the laws are not necessarily a reflection of justice, a reflection of morality, but often of something very different. And of course, I was dismissed. But just think about that. The law is not... It's codified. That is, in a way, it's dead. If you have people who take every situation, right, individually, and people who are intelligent, people who have been used to commanding their own intelligence and their own ideas and their own morality, they can come. They can generate much more just decisions. Particularly in conjunction with other people. And I felt that when the judge told me, no, you should not follow your own moral instincts. You should, you know, decide, you should just follow what I tell you. And if you disagree, then too bad. That, I think, was a very symbolic reflection of our system of law. On the one hand, like I say, it absolves the biggest criminals, the government and the, you know, the capitalist institutions. On the other, it corrupts the people because it basically dulls their sense of morality and their sense of understanding, and it of course discounts the institutional influence of the of corrupting institutions like. The workplace and the consumerism, etc. And lastly, it basically delivers a dead rather than an alive form of justice. Justice need not coincide with the law. The law is to a large extent a reflection of class privilege, and the law, in fact, has been written and has been shaped, as I said, by powerful institutions. Charnchi, perhaps you can talk about a little bit about how this, in fact, goes a little bit back to maybe the Tao Te Ching, because the Tao Te Ching has a sort of anarchist streak, and they talk about how the more corrupt a society is, the more laws you need. And that's when I first read that, I thought, wow, that sounds kind of strange. I thought a society with more laws was more noble and more civilized. But the Tao Te Ching said, no, the more corrupt a society is, the more laws you have.
Yeah, so I'm supposed to be the Taoist expert in house, I guess.
Right, I guess we have the stereotype because you're, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. In that passage, he was talking about kind of ranking of different type of societies, and he's saying like because at the time they're always talking, you know, the Confucians, the Confucianists uh-huh. were talking about, you know, law and order, and that's how you run a society, and he was trying to go beyond that, saying, you know, like. That rank, maybe second, but the best kind of society is that people who, you know, just go about their business and they don't even know what structures are in place.
In fact, the InfoShop, the anarchist FAQ, they say that... what they suggest, instead of the current legal system or even the alternative law system based on religious or natural laws, so-called natural laws, is custom.
Mm-hmm.
And they say the development of living rules of thumb which express what a society considers as right at any given moment. And says, well, what is the difference between this order of custom and the rule of law? It says, custom is a body of living institutions that enjoys the support of the body politic, whereas law is a codified, that is a dead, body of institutions that separates social control from moral force. Now, of course, a lawyer may say, hey, but the law changes all the time. The law is alive. It's true that the law changes after people pressure it to change. But there's two aspects to that. First of all, it's not immediate. It's not like the people decide and then the moral decision is delivered. You have an unjust law, and maybe it can be changed in the future, maybe not. But many laws are simply not enforced because the power realities in the society do not allow it. So I don't know if you remember this, Charnchi. Actually, you were not there during the Howard Zinn talk, right? When I went to Boston, because we were recording it. But Howard Zinn spoke about how, you know, the 13th and 14th Amendments of the Constitution. You know, about not taking away privileges from people and all those things. You know, they were not enforced for 100 years. All kinds of violations of them. So you can have all kinds of beautiful laws written on paper. In fact, remember that at the IWW, they told us, look, if you go to Mexico, you know, you read the books, you read the labor laws there, you have all kinds of great rights. Wow, you know, you have the right to do this, right to do that. Yeah, it's on paper, you know. If it doesn't reflect the realities on the ground, the actual realities of power, which are reflected in the public consciousness, those laws are worthless. You know, you can have all kinds of nice laws. And I remember in Chomsky's debate with, conversation with Foucault back in, I think it was 74, wasn't it? He said, look, there's many laws in the state's own legal system that demand that the state cease to perpetrate these criminal actions. So I mean, that's why, in fact, Chomsky very often, supports the law, supports international law, and so on, because it you know, these laws have been codified very often in a certain manner that looks as if it's moral, and maybe they were pushed forward by people who genuinely felt this was necessary and it was moral, but the power centers are not following those laws. So,
I was actually gonna bring that up when you started talking about laws. Foucault during that debate was saying, you know, was trying to get at what Chomsky's basis was, about his because Chomsky was saying that first of all, we shouldn't let the state define what is legal and illegal, you know. And so Foucault was trying to get at, well, are you talking about some perfect justice, you know, some kind of justice system that's ideal or whatever? And Chomsky was saying, you know, like, it's not just the, you know, system of laws and within a state. It's used as a tool of oppression oftentimes, but it's also, you can see kind of a grasping towards a better system of justice.
Right, right.
It's not just a monolithic. So right. We could using the part of the mechanism that it's kind of democratizing the state, basically, like you always talk about, you know. Making the state, comply with these kind of laws.
And its own laws, because the state itself does not comply with its own laws. And I remember that when Chomsky said it's not ideal law or perfect law, it's better law. I mean, or better justice. We tend to equate law with justice, but that's not necessarily the case. But some of those laws embody justice or a more just outcome that is not seen in the actions of the state, or, you know, obviously the corporate structures that dominate our society. But you know, the this also takes us to the another argument that Foucault and Chomsky were discussing, and that is the concept of you know, the feasibility of doing something that may bring about a worse outcome. So, for example, when Chomsky was challenged that, look, you know, if you try to overthrow the things that we have now, we may end up with something worse. And Chomsky's answer was, well, but sort of like you have this war going on in Vietnam, just back in the 70s, and he says, if you protest, if you challenge the state, you may end up with fascism. That wouldn't be good for the United States. It wouldn't be good for Europe. It wouldn't be good for the world. But nevertheless, if you don't do anything, then the society of Indochina will be destroyed. The slaughter will continue. So in the face of those uncertainties, we have to take a course of action. And he says, and the same thing happens in the intellectual realm. We have to take a course of action, and that always takes. It's always risky, but the question is: do we settle for current injustices just because we're afraid that a future society will be more unjust, even though we know we have the potential to improve our moral standing and the moral standing of the whole society?
Yeah. Sorry, I was in the chat room.
Anybody's got any questions there? Okay.
Not really. Let's see.
Well, I mean, you know, and this is something that I heard from The Economist, the Australian economist, what's his name, Steve Keen, whom I interviewed a few months back. And, you know, he's actually he's a very good economist, and he's sort of a Marxian, post-Keynesian economist, more left economist, who rejects the whole, you know, the whole so-called science of economics, because it's full of garbage. He's got his own explanations that make much more sense. But he nevertheless said, look, I acknowledge capitalism is an exploitative system. We have a capitalist class that exploits a working class. You have a hierarchy, you know, maybe people in the middle, managers and others. And yes, they expropriate a lot of the surplus created by workers. And the workers, depending on their stage of the class struggle, they are robbed of more or less of the value they produce. Yes. So he says, but why do I not think it's always a good idea to get rid of capitalism? And he says, well, because you could get something worse. You could get Stalinism, right? But the question here is, do we actually settle for what we have right now? Or do we actually struggle forward? Because the thing is that if we don't struggle forward, they struggle forward. It's not like, you know, let's just keep it the way it is. That we have a very conscious and you know, strong force in society, always trying to take back what we gained. It's not like this is a stable situation where if we just let go, it'll stay the same. No, the gains that we have were hard earned. They were tooth and nail battles. So anyway,
right. I think those are tactical questions. You know, like you can't really talk about it in abstract. You know, like we all live in under different conditions, and you know, institutions work differently. You know, we have to kind of judge for ourselves what tactics to use. You know, so in Chomsky's time, he felt that resistance, even though there's a risk, that it was the right tactic. And if you ask him now, I think he would say that resistance should take a different form, like more education. And because, you know, he feels like that consciousness is right underneath the surface, whereas in the 60s, it wasn't really there, you know. The control is much much heavier. So it depends on, like, it's something we have to all evaluate for ourselves, I think.
Right. But and this is another problem that I've always faced when I talk about criminal actions, when I talk about corruption and the society and individual actions and the human spirit, you know, that we always ask ourselves, where is that corruption coming from? And, you know, my liberal friend always says, well, it's your personal choice. If you know, Americans are obese because they are making the personal choice of eating more. People commit crimes because they're making the personal choice of doing this. And my response is always that that's not the only factor. And I always give the example, if I invite you over for dinner, okay, and you have to choose between, say, I tell you, you can choose chicken or fish, right? And you say, well, I like both, but I'll go with the fish, you know, because I like it better. And I say, okay, well, the chicken is cooked and ready to eat, but if you want fish, you're going to have to go to the lake 2 miles away. You're going to have to catch the fish. You got to bring it back. You got to cook it, and then you can eat it, right? It's our lake, so we give you permission to fish in the lake, so you can get the fish if you want. So it's your personal choice. But I've made it so hard for you and that you're going to choose what's easier. So similarly, society from the very second we enter our sort of social life and we started being exposed to the influence of universities, schools, you know, social life in general, certain options in every conceivable way are made easier to pursue. So it's easy for you to pursue a consumerist sort of behavior. It's easy for you to not look at the homeless. It's easy for you to support the government. It's easy for you, easy for you, easy for you, easy for you. That's how they do it. So they lure you into all these, you know, little sort of traps that end up amounting to a shaping of your personality. So they shape your personality by and then they create habits, you know. So if you keep doing something over and over again, pretty much it becomes a habit. It becomes a psychological habit, and that makes it harder for you to later on develop a more moral approach to life. And what the liberals do, people who always talk about personal choice, is ignore that institutional context, ignore that environmental pressure, ignore the influence of the structure of the system, and simply concentrate on the personal choices that the person makes without looking at the institutional framework. And I mean, if that were the case, then how come different personal choices were made in the Middle Ages, and in the Roman Empire, and in the 19th century, and in the 20th century? We've had different choices because the framework has changed. People's genetic endowment has not changed. People are fundamentally the same today as they were, you know, 100 or 200,000 years ago. People who do not want to look at the institutional structure of the system, they're trying to protect the status quo. I think that's pretty undeniable.
Yeah, or if you're, like, in my case, I'm a vegetarian, so you're really repressed under this coercive set of choices, right?
Right, right.
Like, well, if you offer me fish and chicken, I have no choice in the matter. Yeah. But anyways,
yeah, you know, and maybe you can talk about that. The thing about vegetarianism, I've always, every time I discuss it, I said, look, if you lived in a if most humans lived in collectives, right, and we lived in an anarchist society which discussed things like food production, people were in control of their food production, they could have an open, honest discussion about the food we eat, and I'm willing to bet, and if the collectives and the neighborhoods where you lived were sort of a gift economy where people, you know, had big cookouts, I'm sure you would have a huge percentage of vegetarianism. I think it, so. Once again, the environment in that would play an enormous role. You would have many more vegetarians. Like I try to, like where I live, for example, you know, it's expensive to live in San Francisco where I live, and you know, where I live, they give me food, right? They have a diner downstairs. And the food is kind of cheap food, you know, and they give you a lot of chicken, a lot of, you know, just cheap food, turkey, and you know, and sort of like I end up eating it because. You know, I don't want to spend the money. I don't. It's like very often there's no vegetarian option, and you know, I don't want to. You know, I don't want to spend money. I'm not. I don't want to. It's not like I don't have a job now, and so it's sort of like they don't make it easy for you to pursue. And our society, of course, worships meat. It's like, oh, you know, well, the hamburger and the steak and. So, I mean, you have been a vegetarian for a few years now, so what's your take on that? Charanchi, are you there? Oh, you got disconnected. Okay, well, let's go to a break. I guess we can play a little song here, and then we can answer some questions and go back to what we were doing. Well, I'm going to play Muse by Uprising, and when we get back, you can call if you want. Once again, the number is 646-716-8106. That's the guest number, 646-716-8106. Uprising by Muse. All right, there we are.
Yeah.
All right, folks, that was Muse. Yeah, in fact, I never heard of that group before, and we, you know, we have to get new music here on the show every day, so that keep it fresh. Once again, 646-716-8106. Call in if you want. We have a lot of material here that we can discuss. So anyway, Charchi, you there?
Yeah.
Maybe we can continue with the conversation earlier about vegetarianism. What's your take on that? How the society makes it easy for people to be meat eaters and not vegetarians?
Well, I think part of it's the grip of agribusiness on society. I mean, they control a lot of the food industry. So, you know, in some sense, it's like, I don't know, it really upholds the system of, you know, like 80% of the corn production goes to animal feed and things like that. It's like a ready-made market. So they keep pushing these new products on. And also the factory farms are just crazy, but you know it's very profitable to produce all this crappy food. But my personal thing with vegetarianism was kind of an ethical one. Like I didn't want to partake in the cruelty anymore. And even if you Well, I'm a purist, so I don't think you should kill any animals for food. But there are some people who argue, like, free range is okay, you know. Or if you hunt for your food, it's okay. But I think, you know, it's my personal choice. I don't try to judge others for their, you know, because it's so deeply seated, you know, meat eating.
What do you think about... do you think about cannibalism? Do you think that it's morally as atrocious as eating animals, or worse, or how do you see cannibalism?
Well, to me, I think it could be slightly more odious, but I think it's on par with eating animals. And I'm sorry, that's. You know, that's just my own, you know, it's my own feeling. And so if you extend the meat eater's logic on why they eat meat, then that, I think that's, you know, that maybe that's an extreme, but you have to say that eating people is
right.
On the same
spectrum. We just perceive our own intelligence, our own consciousness to be so much more valuable than that of an animal, a cow.
Yeah, and then for some people, they're, you know, animals that you know it's ethically wrong to eat, like dogs or whatever, you know, something you can have as pets. So what's the difference between a dog and a pig, let's say? Like, you know, I don't see any differences in the cruelty that goes into it.
Right.
So for me, I'm kind of a curious on this one, but you know, you can't change it all in one day, so I'm not gonna judge people for it. I think I could present arguments, like strong arguments, in many different areas, like, you know, even environmental and economic arguments. But
let me ask you a question, because earlier you were talking about how you sent me a message talking about relating our earlier conversation to not interfering with contracts, which is a sort of a free market sort of argument. What were you referring to?
Yeah, I was talking in the chat room. I brought up this. There was a resolution in the U.S. Senate about. Because there are contractors in Iraq, I think it's a subsidiary of Halliburton, and their employees, their male employees, were gang raping one of the coworkers. Okay, and she tried to press charges. She came back and sued the company, but the company's, well, the courts basically say you can't sue the company, right? Because it's in your contract. It's in the fine print of the contract. Al Franken, who's a Democratic, who's a comedian, but now he's a Democratic senator, and he brought this resolution saying that, you know, we should intervene on this situation, because that's, you know, we have to help hold them accountable, because that was a criminal act. But what happened was the vote came out against it, and most of the negative votes were from the GOP, and their argument was basically, you know, government shouldn't be interfering with private contracts. That's
right.
The typical
libertarian.
Yeah.
Well,
this
I mean,
is
what,
mind-boggling, but okay.
Well, I mean, it's obviously not something that gets applied throughout the spectrum. So when the rich folks need to bailouts, need to you know, in a pure capitalist society, yeah, you have all these contracts and you got to enforce them, and but obviously people like them, they get all kinds of handouts and they get to violate all these contracts for the powerful. The important thing is to keep the wage slaves, you know, to maintain the discipline of the marketplace for the wage slaves who rent themselves out to the capitalists. That's the most important thing. So this woman, I mean, sort of like when you go into an employer, right? You look for a job, and you know, and you're lucky. I mean, in our economy, you're lucky to even have one employer that gives you a job. But let's say you have like two or three choices, okay, of jobs that are sort of reasonable for you, and okay, so and you have the contracts, right? Now, do you think those contracts are something that people want to sign in, you know, do you think they want to follow those instructions and those regulations? No, but that's the only option they have. They can choose among different oppressors. That's what wage slavery means. You can, if you're lucky, you can choose between different bosses. You have to rent yourself to these bosses. Now, the fact that you have to work for them, or else, you know, or else you suffer poverty, social stigma, even starvation in countries without a social welfare system, you know, you are not in favor of that contract. You're signing it because of the condition of wage slavery. Now, those who want to enforce the contract and say, well, the sanctity of contracts, we have to understand under which environment, under which framework are they being signed. And the framework is sort of like, I'm sure, Charity, you've heard about when Chomsky talks about Cuba and say Guantanamo, and how the you know, the contract that was signed to allow the United States to use that part of Cuba, and now of course they've kept it, was in a coercive environment. You know, it was basically you know, they were faced with the barrel of a gun. They were not in a free situation where they could actually make a voluntary decision. So voluntary decisions in a coercive framework are simply not something that is voluntary, because the framework is not voluntary. So people who want to enforce such contracts, they basically want to enforce the framework of wage slavery, and they don't want the government, because the government at least can be potentially democratic. It can be influenced by the public to some extent. So that means that they can try to constrain some of the abuses of the private tyrannies that control our economy. So that's the I think their main argument. And the reason why these so-called libertarians are supporting this position is precisely because they don't realize the the involuntary coercive nature of the very framework which in which they want to have these contracts. Yeah. So, anyway, yeah. Are you there, Charnchi?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. What can you say? And once again, we keep going back to the law. This dead contract, this dead piece of paper that is superior to a something that everybody knows to be moral. Everybody knows that rape, that you know, all these sort of things are immoral, yet they nevertheless stick to the codified law, to the codified contract, to these dead laws, to these dead pieces of paper. Why? Because this is symbolic. This death reflects their own rotten system. It reflects their own values. It reflects their own civilization. So if you allow morality, if you allow something that's alive, that is you know, making decisions that are based on justice and common understanding and public knowledge and democracy, that's very dangerous. You should not allow it. You should try to crush it. And I mean, if I was one of them, sure. I mean, I would do the same thing. You know, enforce contracts and make him. You know, you signed the contract, so that must mean that you were in favor of everything that was on that contract. And there's no such thing as wage slavery. Everything is voluntary. And isn't that wonderful? That everything is voluntary. And it's a total disgrace. But you know, we should learn about ourselves by looking at these things. I think that's very important. So anyway, so do we have any callers? Any questions from the chat room? No, okay. Guess we're gonna go on to the next section of the anarchist FAQ and talk about crime, okay? Because that's another aspect of the law. And for anarchists, crime is primarily described as an antisocial act. You know, behavior that harms someone else or which invades their personal space. And anarchists argue that the root cause of crime is not the perversity of human nature. It's not the perversity of the human condition. Rather, what it is the systemic influence under which we live. So, in fact, Buddha Jim, our co-host, who hasn't been around for a few weeks now, but he made a video talking about how most crimes and showing evidence of how most crimes are property crimes. Something about 90%, something on that range, are property crimes, and that has to do with the incompatibility of our system of exploitative property and of greed with the implementation and the existence of a just order. That's right there is a huge sort of the pink elephant in the room, the amount of crime in the society. So that's undoubtedly a very shocking statistic. And, you know, anarchists don't think that crime can be divorced from the society within which it occurs. Emma Goldman once said that the society gets the criminals it deserves. So, for example, anarchists do not think it's unusual to expect that crime will explode under, so-called free market capitalist regimes like Margaret Thatcher or Reagan. In fact, crime took about 30 years to double in Britain, from about 1 million incidents in 1950 to 2.2 million in 1979. However, between 1979 and 1992, the crime rate more than doubled, exceeding the 5 million mark in 1992. And, you know, as anyone who knows about this period, these 13 years were marked by a government firmly committed to the so-called free market and so-called individual responsibility, which just means tough luck for the poor and handouts for the rich. So it was entirely predictable. So these are the effects of an alienating society, you know, an atoma society, a society that does not allow people to realize their moral and intellectual capacities, a society that doesn't allow people to take responsibility for their actions, to take control over their productive lives and the means of production, a society that does not allow a public participation and community participation, and which kills solidarity. That's not a society that encourages a reduction in crime. A society that encourages crime, and then it blames, as I said earlier, the very people who are being corrupted for their own problems. That's like they say, you know, like I said earlier, those who put out the people's eyes reproach them of their blindness. So that's something that we always see ignored in the media. and capitalism and the contract theory on which it's built will inevitably rip apart society. I think it was Barry Pateman, when I was in Santa Cruz, who spoke about how anarchism was more based on morality, on trust, those kind of relationships. And once you have you'd start relying more on contracts to do everything, more on laws, on coercion, then you start seeing the degradation and corruption of human beings. I think we have Charnchi back. Hey, Charnchi, you back?
Yeah, just going in and out.
Having some problems with the connection. Yeah, yep. Do you want to add anything to the discussion here? To my monologue?
No. I was in and out of the chatting too, so I wasn't paying attention.
Okay, so is anybody there? Anybody there have any questions?
I haven't seen any. Think they're all nodding to the great leader, I guess.
Right. But,
Mr. Bolshevik. Just kidding.
That's me. I would like to read a quote from Eric Fromm. He says, "It would seem that the amount of destructiveness to be found in individuals is proportionate to the amount to which expansiveness of life is curtailed. Freedom of life is curtailed. By this, we do not refer to individual frustrations of this or that instinctive desire, but to the thwarting of the whole of life, the blockage of spontaneity, of the growth and expression of man's sensuous, emotional, and intellectual capacities. Life has an inner dynamism of its own. It tends to grow, to be expressed, to be lived. The drive for life and the drive for destruction are not mutually interdependent factors, but are in a reversed interdependence. The more the drive toward life is thwarted, the stronger is the drive toward destruction. The more life is realized, the less is the strength of destructiveness. Destructiveness is the outcome of unlived life. Those individual and social conditions that make for suppression of life produce the passion for destruction that forms, so to speak, the reservoir from which particular hostile tendencies, either against others or against oneself, are nourished." So I think that's a key insight from our very esteemed libertarian Marxist Eric Fromm. He spoke about in his book To Have or To Be about the difference between the mode of having and the mode of being, and I think that all these things that we see in our society, like these laws, the police, the commodity mentality that emanates out of capitalism, the sexual relations of people who have a very sort of a materialistic view of human relations, a society based on contracts, all these things are based on that to have mode of being. And in contrast, the tendency toward anarchism, the tendency toward 90 participation, seconds. That's based on the being mode, and that's the mode toward which we should struggle. Anyway, folks, well, I guess I've been talking for quite a long time. Hopefully we'll get David back in the show next week, and so I'm going to leave you with a song here from the Spanish Civil War, which I'm sure you'll like, because I like it, so I'm sure that
60 seconds.
You will enjoy it. It's called Ay Carmela. All right. See you next week, folks.
Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
Viva la Quinta Brigada, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Viva la Quinta Brigada, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Que nos cubrirá de gloria, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Que nos cubrirá de gloria, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Luchamos contra los moros, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Luchamos contra los moros, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Mercenarios y fascistas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Mercenarios y fascistas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Ejército del Ebro, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. El ejército del Ebro, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. La otra noche el río cruzó, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. La otra noche el río cruzó, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Ya las fuerzas invasoras, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Ya las fuerzas invasoras, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Buena paliza le dio, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Buena paliza le dio, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Los frentes de Granada, en los frentes de Granada, no tenemos días lunes, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. No tenemos días lunes, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Tenemos días martes, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Y tenemos días martes, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Con los tanques y granadas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Con los tanques y granadas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela.